This is our class number two. The subject is 2,520 years of fulfilled prophecy. Of course, we started yesterday with the subject, Our Day is Like Noah's. And we endeavored to point out the comparison between the conditions in the world just prior to the coming of Christ and the conditions that existed just prior to the flood during the time of Noah. And we found out that it's amazing, the conditions that existed at that time. The earth, we might summarize it by saying, the earth was filled with violence and corruption. And certainly today we're living in a time when the earth is filled with violence and corruption. So I think it's very apparent that we are living in those days like Noah's. So certainly we would expect our day to be like Noah's. Now, in order to deal with some of the time periods that we expect to work with later in the week, the Lord willing, we need to have a background. We need to be able to discuss with you how we have arrived, or how world conditions have arrived at their present status. Because as we try to follow time periods and dates, we will need to refer to these events that have been transpiring for some 2,520 years now. And if we stop and talk about what these events are and what they mean and their place in history at that time, we'll lose all continuity of thought. So in order to avoid that, we want to go through these things now. And if we do now, everybody will remember them to the end of the week, won't you? Sure you will. The remarks that we are especially interested in, and will be much of the week, are found in the 16th chapter of Revelation. We might just take a quick look at that. I'm sure that most of us are familiar with it. But this is describing the pouring out of the sixth vial. And beginning with verse 12, "And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are spirits of devils, working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole world, to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty." Now, one thing it's necessary to remember as we read down through these verses, we're still in the period of the pouring out of the sixth vial. Now, that hasn't changed. We're still in that period. This has been discussing the drying up of the river Euphrates and the unclean spirits like frogs. And now verse 15 is the real kernel of this whole thing as far as we're concerned. Christ said, "Behold, I come as a thief." Now, we can stop there, because this is the thing that we should bear in mind, that it is during the pouring out of the sixth vial that Christ will appear. He has said so. "Behold, I come as a thief." Now, the way in which this applies is that he will come as a surprise upon the world, and maybe even upon the household if we are not very watchful, because we have the indication that he will come in an hour when ye think not. So we should be very careful that we are not in the condition of the world in any sense of the word. Otherwise, this coming may be as a thief to us as well. Now, one thing I might have said yesterday that I didn't think of and didn't remember to talk about the references that I have used in preparing these notes, and it is primarily Eureka, Dr. Thomas's Eurekas, and Light for the Last Days by Dr. and Mrs. Grattan Guinness. Now, there are a number of other books. Of course, I was quoting from one yesterday, The Bible as History by Warner Keller. And also there is some references will be made to the decline and fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbon. So there are a number of these, but it's primarily the Eurekas and Light for the Last Days by Dr. Grattan and Mrs. Guinness. Now, we would like to take this opportunity. Our authority must be the Bible, of course. But we'd also like to encourage you to read some of the writings from the past, because you will find, the key as to why we need to remind you and encourage you to read such books as Eureka and Light for the Last Days is because they were written a long time ago, and there is a lot more depth involved in those writings than a lot that you will find today, because people are inclined to be much more superficial in their thinking and their expression of their thoughts in writing today than they were in the time of Dr. Thomas. Now, it's not easy to read Dr. Thomas, but you will find a lot more depth of understanding contained in the writings of Dr. Thomas than you will in the writings of the new books that are coming on the market today by the bucketfuls from certain sources. So we would like to encourage you to read, especially the Eurekas, but if you have a chance to read Grattan Guinness, you should also read him. Now, he was not a Christadelphian, but he has some very worthwhile thoughts on the subject of prophecy. Now, at the time the Bible was written, there much of it had to do with events that were yet future, that had not occurred yet, and that we call prophecy. But as these events did occur over the years, as time passed, then they were no longer prophecy, but they had become history. So when we look at 2,520 years of fulfilled prophecy, it was prophecy when it was given, but it has now become history. So we might also say we're going to be considering 2,520 years of history. Depends on which way you want to look at it. But God's plan and purpose with the earth and mankind upon it has been in the process of development all during this time, and we see evidence of that when we look at the history or fulfilled prophecy. And we find much of that described in the book of Daniel, in Nebuchadnezzar's image, and in the four beasts that Daniel saw, as recorded in Daniel chapter 7. Now, we also find that the development of God's plan and purpose is very closely keyed to the natural descendants of Abraham and the Promised Land. If we want to know at what point or at what stage of development God's plan is in at any given time, we look at the status of the natural descendants of Abraham, the Jews, and the Promised Land at that particular time to see what was going on there. Because the development of God's plan is very closely keyed to those two elements. And when we look back now, some 2,500 years, we see the nation of Israel established as a kingdom, in fact, as the kingdom of God in the Promised Land. And to them had been committed the oracles of God in the form of the law of Moses. And as we indicated yesterday, the law of Moses in itself was not calculated to give them eternal life. But their continued prosperity in the land was very definitely tied to their obedience to that law. It was contingent upon their keeping the law very carefully. And the zenith of the kingdom of Israel was reached during the reign of King David and King Solomon. And shortly after that, we might say that a state of sin set in, and that, they were told, would bring about their ultimate destruction. If they were not careful to obey God, they would suffer very severely as a result. And some of the things that would happen would be that they would be scattered among all nations of the world, and that their land, the promised land, which is actually God's land, would be ruled over by their enemies. That's two of the things that were to occur if they were not obedient to the law that God had given them. So because of the state that set in, even in the time of Solomon, as for that matter, the kingdom of Israel was divided into two following Solomon's reign and during the reign of his son Rehoboam, divided into the 10 tribes Israel and the 2 tribes Judah. And this decline continued until the 10 tribes were ultimately overrun by the Assyrians, and the 2 tribes continued to be ruled for some period of time by the house of David, but they failed to learn the lesson that they should have learned from the fate of their 10 brethren that were overrun by the Assyrians, and their power continued to decline. And ultimately there were incursions by the Egyptians and by the Babylonians that further weakened their power. And at last, they too were taken captive, but into Babylon, by the Babylonians, those who succeeded the Assyrians in power. So from that time, then, they were to be ruled over, and their land was to be ruled over, by their enemies, by the Gentiles, for a period of 2,500 years, 2,520 years. Now there's some observations that might be made relative to these developments. Now these are important because these are things that you're going to remember to the end of the week. That when Israel was exalted as a kingdom, the kingdom of God, the Gentile nations were abased. So if we have the Israel, the Jews, up here, the Gentile powers down here. And then when Israel is abased, the Gentile powers are exalted. Now, this is one of the things that we need to keep in mind, that the two are not up at the same time. When one is up, the other is down. Now, another thing, when we go back to the time when Israel was exalted, in the days when they were the kingdom of God, and that decline, the decline set in which they were ultimately abased, this did not occur all at once. Now, Brother Ted Farrer has developed an interesting theory, which he calls the teeter-totter theory. Now, as youngsters, we all got on teeter-totters, and you go up and down, and this is what happened. Well, now, the teeter-totter, when Israel was up and the Gentiles were down, it wasn't a situation where Israel was up one day and the next day they were down like that. They came down very gradually over a long period of time, so that we start thinking not necessarily of dates, and though we will, the Lord willing, be discussing dates, but it's more important to think in terms of eras. So there was an era in which the power of Israel declined. And Grattan Guinness places that era at 160 years. He said it took 160 years from the time that the Gentile powers began to ascend and the power of Israel began to descend until they were actually carried away and their power destroyed. So that the decline of Israel was progressive in nature. It didn't happen all at once. And as the Israel declined, as we said, the Gentile powers were exalted. Now we come down to the time of King Nebuchadnezzar, and this was during the time of the prophet Daniel. And we find Nebuchadnezzar dreaming a dream. And in fact, there were a couple of things that were rather important that occurred in the life of Nebuchadnezzar. And they both occurred in the same year. He dreamed the dream of his image, Nebuchadnezzar's image. And he ascended the throne of Babylon as the sole ruler that same year. Now, prior to that time, he had been ruling in Babylon, but as co-ruler with his father. And when he ascended the throne alone, and the dream of Nebuchadnezzar's image occurred, in 604 B.C. That doesn't show very clearly, does it? Can you see that back there? 604 B.C. Now, well, you might if you'd like while we're talking, because I won't use it on a regular basis. Oh, Gary's got a bigger. I had one like this, but I said that I don't need one like that. That's too big. But 604 B.C. That's a date that we should remember, should keep that in mind as we go along. And we'll refer to others, but that's one we'd like to have you remember. Now, we have referred to Nebuchadnezzar's dream there of the great image. And we can't go into this in detail because our time, even though Jim very graciously gave us 10 extra minutes this morning, we that doesn't allow us enough time to go in detail. We will only present a very brief outline here of these events. But when Nebuchadnezzar saw this image, it was, assume, and I think the evidence bears this out, that it was in the form of a man, though it does not call it a man. Maybe we should wait until another, or are you able to get it? Are you going to be able to? Okay. It was in the form of a man, and the head was of gold, the breast and arms of silver, the belly and thighs of brass, and the legs of iron. Now we find out from what Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar that these various parts of the image represented nations or empires. That Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold, Babylon, the first one, the starting point. And but that his nation, his power, would not continue on as he hoped it would when he constructed an image all of gold, but that it would be superseded by other powers represented by the silver and the brass and the iron and clay. Let's discontinue that until between classes because it's was revealed to Nebuchadnezzar that his power would be followed by other nations represented by these various bodily parts, as we have said. And finally, by the 10 toes, part of iron, or the feet and toes, part of iron and part of clay. And we might say that the 10 toes represented 10 nations that would ultimately establish themselves upon the territory formerly held by the Roman Empire. And they would all be established on the western half of the Roman Empire. Now, none of the 10 toes were established in the eastern half of the Roman Empire. Now, in the 7th chapter of Daniel, Daniel also saw symbols representing these same empires that the various parts of the image represented, in the order, in the same order, the lion, the bear, the leopard, and the fourth beast, which Daniel described as dreadful and terrible. Now, the identity of these beasts have been known for a long, long time. Sometimes we think that the identification of these beasts belongs strictly to Dr. Thomas, and some of his opponents appear to feel that same way. But this is not necessarily true. As a matter of fact, even about Sir Isaac Newton goes back about 150 years further in time than did Dr. Thomas. But Sir Isaac Newton knew the identity of these four beasts that we find here in Daniel. And you might be interested in hearing how he expressed his thoughts relative to these things. And we have a little quote here from the Grattan Guinness's Light for the Last Days, in which Sir Isaac Newton was describing or giving some thoughts on the last two, the third and fourth beast that Daniel saw in chapter 7. And you'll find him expressing himself in a rather odd way, but kind of interesting. He says, seeing the body of the third beast, now that was the leopard, the third beast, is confined to the nations on this side, the Euphrates, and the body of the fourth beast is confined to the nations on this side of Greece, we are to look for all the four heads of the third beast among the nations on this side of the Euphrates, and the four and all the 11 horns of the fourth beast among the nations on this side of Greece. Now, if you can't follow that, me reading it like this, don't be disappointed, because you have to stop and think about it quite a bit. But basically, he's saying the same thing that Dr. Thomas said when he described and identified the nations represented by these beasts. Of course, Sir Isaac Newton was only commenting on the third and fourth rather than all four. But the fourth beast that Daniel saw was by far the most complex of all the beasts. And like Daniel, we are more interested in it than the others. Now, you will find in Daniel chapter 7, verse 19, that Daniel especially inquired of the angel as to the identity of the fourth beast that he saw, which was great and terrible. Now, this beast had teeth of iron and nails of brass. Now, this immediately turns our attention to the image. While this beast was Roman in nature, the legs of iron, there was also the Greek, the brass influence in it. And we find that this certainly is true, that the Greek and Roman influence have been much stronger down through the centuries than has been the influence of the two first beasts, the lion and the bear. And the ten horns that was on the beast that Daniel saw it to begin with turns our attention to the ten toes of the image. And finally, the little horn that appeared on the head of the fourth beast, which would have been the 11th horn altogether, because it had 10 to start with, and one more made its appearance. And when Sir Isaac was referring to that beast, he said the 11 horns of the beast, and it did have 11 altogether. And this is an interesting horn, the little horn, or the 11th, in that it had eyes and mouth, and speaking great things. And as we have said in the beginning, we can only give a very brief outline of all of this because we don't have the time to go into detail, but we will tell you that this 11th horn, or the little horn of Daniel's fourth beast having eyes and mouth, was very closely associated with the rise of the papacy. And as we move down through history, we'll find where its place is in the development of the plan and purpose of God. Now, it seems a little strange sometimes to talk about these powers contributing to the development of the plan of God when they were so in opposition to God's plan, but they all had their place and part to play in the development of his plan and purpose, even though they were bitterly opposed to it, unwittingly, of course, but nevertheless opposed. And now we come down to the time of Christ and the apostles, where the true doctrine, the true gospel of God's plan was taught the people, the gospel in its purity. But there were a number of warnings from both Christ and the apostle Paul, that grievous wolves would enter in to the flock, not sparing the flock, but would be extremely destructive, in that they would be teaching a false doctrine of one kind or another, which would be devastating for the people of God if they allowed themselves to become involved in this false doctrine. Our gospel, as Paul said in Galatians, which he said is not a gospel at all, but a perversion of the gospel of Christ. And when we come to the time of that the apocalypse was given to John on Patmos, we see ample evidence of the fact that this false teachings that Christ and Paul warned about had made itself known. Now, we heard about that yesterday, and at least two of the ecclesias were in very sad circumstance because of the fact that they were allowing. Now, the message to the seven ecclesias was addressed directly to the star angel, or the eldership, as Dr. Thomas termed it, and they were not accused of holding the false teachings that were in their ecclesia personally, but they said, because you have those that believe these things. So it's vitally important that an ecclesia not allow these things to exist in their membership. And they cannot feel, the people in an ecclesia cannot feel that it's all right if they keep their own skirts clean and allow others in their ecclesia to believe or practice wrong doctrine or conduct. Then Christ would say what he said to those ecclesias, I have somewhat against you, if we allow this to happen. And there was further deterioration as we move along through history. And ultimately, the ecclesias, as the followers of Christ were known then and now, were replaced by the church because of the false doctrine that found its way in into Christianity, so-called. So that ultimately there was simply a hodgepodge of Christianity, Judaism, and paganism, and that was known as the church. And by the time they moved down to 312 and 13, there had been the church had a real champion. Turn that on. In Constantine the Great, 312 to 13. This is when Constantine came to power. And at this point in time, so-called Christianity had come to be recognized as the state religion. The Christians had been persecuted prior to this time. Both true and false Christians had been. But at this point in time, Christianity became the state religion. Now, it doesn't mean that the situation was any better for the real believers, the real brethren of Christ. It was just as bad as it ever had been, because the true followers of Christ and those who dissented for any reason whatsoever had to flee for their very life after Constantine came to power and Christianity became the state religion. Now, if you want to read the prophecy of the establishment of this apostasy, you can look in Revelation chapter 12, where there is the fighting between the dragon and the followers of the woman. And there's a time period involved there that we also will be referring to further along. It's a time period that's referred to in two different ways, as a time, times, and a half a time, and as 1260 days. You'll find those referred to in the 12th chapter of Revelation. There's a time period of equal length, but a different time period, also referred to in the 13th chapter of Revelation as 42 months. We'll be referring to that. Now, as we move on down through the fulfillment of prophecy, and these events we're talking about were the subject of prophecy. They had been, it had been indicated that these things would come about in this way, indicated to the prophet Daniel in symbol and in a very outline form, but nevertheless prophesied, and we see them coming to pass. And in keeping with that, the two legs of the image, two legs of iron that Nebuchadnezzar had seen in the image, we find the Roman Empire, as represented by iron, being divided into Eastern and Western, the Eastern and Western empires, by the two sons of Theodosius. Now that occurred near the end of the 4th century. And finally, the invasion of the western half by the Germanic tribes from the north that came pouring down. And there were 10 of those. And that was coincidental, somebody might say, but it was, if so, it was just coincidental that Daniel said that that would be the case when he was telling Nebuchadnezzar what the meaning of the image was. Now, while all of this was taking place, there was another development that came about which we are greatly interested in, as the church, and that is the rise of the papacy. The rise to power of the papacy. Now, as the church continued to gain influence after it had been perverted and after it became the church, now it was no longer the ecclesias, but the church, then there it began to gain more power and more influence in the affairs of state. And as it did so, there was fierce competition between the bishops of the more important cities, such as Jerusalem and Rome and Constantinople and Alexandria, for power. They wanted to be the ones who controlled. There was a lot of power involved in this thing at this point, and they wanted to be the ones who were in a position to wield that power. Well, of course, we know that the bishop at Rome ultimately won out in this struggle, and he was the one who was ultimately able to do it. And we find that by this time, there was no strong central government in Rome because the 10 Germanic tribes had come down into that area in turn. They didn't all come down at once, but in turn they came down. And the Roman emperor was no longer ruling from Rome, but from Constantinople. And this allowed, this facilitated, we might say, the rise of the papacy in Rome. Now, there was a Cardinal Manning writing in the 1860s, and he had this to say: the abandonment of Rome, that is, by the emperor, was the liberation of the pontiffs. So it was the fact that there was no strong central civil government in Rome that facilitated the rise of the papacy. But for the Pope to really carry out his power as he would like to, he needed help from a civil source of some kind, civil and military. And that help was forthcoming from the emperors in Constantinople. Now, you may think that it would have been a more logical assumption that the emperors would have been left in Rome, so they could really have helped the Pope there. But that wasn't according to the plan and purpose of God. The emperor was in Constantinople, and the Pope was in Rome. But there was a sort of a loose alliance forged between the two, in which they both were benefited, and of course these things don't happen unless there is a mutual benefit of some kind or another for each, or a benefit for each. Now, as we look at this agreement or this alliance that existed between the Pope in Rome and the Emperor in Constantinople, we began to see the emergence of the little horn of Daniel's fourth beast. Now, it didn't reach the zenith of its power in this arrangement, but we began to see the emergence of the little horn of Daniel's fourth beast here. Now, this brings us down to the 6th and 7th centuries A.D., when this began to come about. And during this general period, there was a number of auspicious developments for the church that occurred, which allowed the papacy to ultimately rule with an iron hand in both church and state. Now, one of those developments is the decree of the Emperor Phocas, the decree of Phocas. Now, briefly stated, this decree conceded to Pope Boniface III and the succeeding popes the headship over all churches in Christendom. This is why the Pope could assume so much power. It's because it was given him by the emperor in Constantinople, Phocas. And it was during this period of time, according to Grattan Guinness, that anti-heretical decrees were first promulgated, and legal intolerance of the true faith of the saints furnished means for future persecution and oppression. This came about during this period of time. So now we see, and we might say now, that in this we see now the real beginning of the little horn of Daniel's fourth beast. We have to recognize now that that came into being at the time the decree of Phocas was issued. Now, generally, we have said in the past that this did not come about until about 200 years later, in the year of 800, when the alliance between Charlemagne, King of France, and the Pope came about. But the problem with that is that we also say it existed 1,260 years, and that's scriptural, and our time periods are off unless we start it with the decree of Phocas. And we do that when we're working with a time period, but when we say the little horn of Daniel's fourth beast came into being was in 800, but that doesn't give it enough time. So the time now that this decree of Phocas was issued was the period from 606 to 610. Now, the decree was issued by Phocas in 606, and it was being implemented from then until 610 when Phocas died. So this era from 606 to 610 is a very important date, because there's a time period we'll be referring to that has its beginning, and that era of 606 to 610. Now, as we move ahead, we come to the alliance between Charlemagne, King of France, and Pope Leo III in Rome, and that occurred in 800 A.D. And that is what has been referred to in history as the Holy Roman Empire. Now, you may hear the Roman Empire itself being referred to as the Holy Roman Empire. That's a misnomer. That term is not applied to the Roman Empire per se. It's applied to this alliance that came about between Charlemagne, King of France, and Pope Leo III, and succeeding popes and kings, of course. And when this occurred, then there was total union between church and state, so that the kings were now crowned or anointed, if we might use that term, by the Pope. And, of course, in turn, the king was blessed in this way, and in turn the Pope received military and civil support from the king to carry out his declared intentions of ridding the empire, or the whole world for that matter, if they could, of anybody who dissented from the belief and teachings of the church. So that the little horn of Daniel's beast, fourth beast, had now come into power in full glory. So we see the eyes and the mouth of the little horn representing the ecclesiastical powers, or the Pope or the papacy, and the horn itself representing the military or civil power involved in this alliance. And persecution of dissenters was severe and extensive during this time. And this arrangement now was destined to last about 1,000 years. However, France was not always... Now, France was termed the eldest son of the church, because they were the first to support the Pope. But they were not always the country that did this. It passed on to a number of other countries during this period of 1,000 years. The country to succeed France was Germany, and this occurred in the 11th century. And it's interesting now in all of this to contemplate how the Pope could successfully rule with an iron hand in both church and state, oftentimes in opposition to a king who could command hundreds of thousands of armed troops. And yet the Pope had very few troops. Now, how could this be that the Pope could rule in this way? The answer is by the power of excommunication. All the subjects of the king were taught to believe that without a doubt, if they took an order from an excommunicated king, that was almost a sure ticket for their immortal souls to spend eternity in the burning flames of hell. This is what they were taught. Now, that goes back, we've talked about how this belief came about so the people could be controlled. And you can see the way in which this worked so successfully in controlling the people, because they were afraid. If a king was excommunicated by the Pope, he couldn't even tell his housekeeper what to do. Nobody would do what the king said. So in this way, the Pope could rule in both church and state. Now, that is brought to our attention very forcefully in the dispute that arose between Pope Gregory the VII and King Henry the IV of Germany in the year 1076. Now, at this time, King Henry declared that the Pope was no longer fit to be Pope, so he was going to replace him. Well, what happened was the Pope excommunicated the king, and then King Henry the IV couldn't do anything. So what happened was that the Pope forced him to go to travel in the dead of winter from Germany over the Italian Alps to Rome, and then wait outside 3 days barefoot before the king would, or the Pope would even give him an audience, so that he could be reinstated. So if you have any doubt as to who had the upper hand during this period of time, that is an excellent example to illustrate that point. Now, finally, the dubious honor of protecting the Pope was passed on to Austria, and that occurred about the end or near the end of the 17th century. And it wasn't long after this until the French Revolution occurred, and all of the resulting chaos that took place during and in the aftermath of the French Revolution, including the Napoleonic Wars, Austria was so weakened that she could no longer successfully defend the Pope. And the papacy suffered a number of humiliating reverses during the time of Napoleon, including being arrested and taken to Paris, imagine, of all things, and even having his states seized by the French and annexed to France. So the power that's, or the nation, France, that started out as the eldest son of the church and protecting the Pope and with civil and military power in the time of Charlemagne, ultimately contributed very largely to the downfall of the papacy and the loss of power. So finally, Austria was no longer able to defend the Pope, and the Pope had his own forces, but they were not that numerous. So they were ultimately defeated by the Italian army, and the Pope's temporal powers were suspended or taken away, and he has been referred to as a prisoner of the Vatican ever since. And we come to another important date here when we talk about that. The Pope lost his temporal powers in the era from 1866 to 70, a period of 4 years. Now, any of you are inclined to work with figures, you will see a certain correlation between these two figures here. And they are very important in our consideration as we move along. Now, while the papacy was being developed in the West, the Western half of the Roman Empire, there a very important development was taking place in the eastern half of the Roman Empire. Now, sometimes this apostasy that established itself in the western half of the Roman Empire that we've been talking about, the papacy, is referred to as the apostasy of the West. Now, there was an apostasy of the East being developed at this very same time, right along during the same time periods that the papacy was coming to the front. There was an apostasy and a power in the East being developed. And that is Mohammedanism, or Islam, that was asserting itself. So now we find, well, let us move down a little ways. We're going to run out of time here, as always do in trying to cover this. But as we move down, we find that the apostasy of the East, Islam, asserted itself in Jerusalem, or conquered Jerusalem, in 637 A.D. So now we're beginning to see a definite division in this period of 2,520 years. There's two very separate and distinct periods of time involved here, each one of 1,260 years duration. Now, during the first 1,260 years, the four beasts of Daniel ruled over the Holy Land, but at the end of that time, in 637 A.D., we find Islam asserting itself in Jerusalem, in the Holy Land, and starting another period of 1,260 years, in which all of which, or during which, the Jews were had been led captive. They were being persecuted in the land of their enemies, and their land was being ruled over by Gentile powers in the person of the four beasts, the first half, in the person of Islam, the Saracens, and the Turks, the second half. Now, if we have time, we might I mentioned to you that the word the Arabs, when they began to rise up and to conquer, and they did from India to Africa during a period of some 400 years or thereabouts, and they call themselves by a name that's kind of interesting. Saracens. Now that's a word that I don't know a lot about, except that Gibbon, in the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, said it was taken from Abraham's wife, Sarah. And the Arabs, can, of course, they're descendants from Abraham, and those who come who came from Ishmael are descendants of Sarah as well. Some of them, they aren't all descended from them. Some are from Hagar, as we know. But they like to consider themselves the descendants of Sarah as well as Abraham. And I don't know a lot about that, but Gibbon seemed to feel that it was significant enough that he mentioned it. And we might say now that where the rise of the of Islam is prophesied is in the ninth chapter of Revelation, during the sounding of the fifth and sixth trumpets, as the locusts that come up out of the bottomless pit, and as the four angels of the Euphrates. But the fall of this power was also predicted, and we read that in the 16th chapter of Revelation, the drying up of the river Euphrates. So that power was not to last always either.